Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
It's time for our latest installment of Unearthed. If you're brand new to the show, this is when a few times a year we talk about things that have been literally or figuratively unearthed over the last few months. Today's installment of Unearthed is going to include some updates, edibles and potables, a number of shipwrecks, and some other stuff. If you have favorites that you're like, I didn't hear that in that list, that may be on Wednesday, or maybe we don't have any. It changes from one installment to the next.
So hang on and see what happens. We have had several updates about the search for victims of the 1921 Tulsa Massacre, which we first covered on the show in July of 2014 and then ran that as a Saturday Classic in November of 2019. This search has included exhumation of some of the bodies from burial sites that may be connected to the massacre. In April, researchers working with the city of Tulsa announced that they had connected DNA from some of those bodies to surnames of people they may be related to. In some cases, they have found some potential genetic relatives.
The city is working with forensic scientists and genealogists from Intermountain Forensics, which has set up a website with this information and so people can provide information they may have about relatives who may have been victims of the massacre. This website is at www.tulsa1921dna.org. Near the top of the page, there's a button that says Learn More, and that'll take you over to the list of surnames at the City of Tulsa website.
As of when we're recording this episode, this has not led to conclusive identification of any of the bodies, but researchers are actively working to gather more information. And again, there is more about this at www.tulsa1921dna.org.
Next, in 2014, we did a two-part episode on the 1629 wreck of the Dutch East India Company Batavia and the mutiny and massacre that followed that. We are going to have this as a Saturday Classic soon. New research on the Batavia was published in the journal Historical Archaeology in May, detailing archaeological work that had been conducted between 2014 and 2019. During this work, researchers found the remains of 12 people who were buried in both single and mass graves, as well as the possible site of the gallows where 7 mutineers were executed. This builds on some other previous research at multiple sites associated with the Batavia, some of which we talked about in that earlier episode. Future work related to this new research is likely to focus on some forensic analysis of those human remains.
Back in 2015, we did an episode on the history of carousels, and that ran as a Saturday classic about a year ago. One of the carousels we talked about had been in Gwyn Oak Amusement Park outside of Baltimore. This was originally a whites-only amusement park, but began to also admit Black visitors on August 28, 1963, the same day as the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The first Black child allowed to ride the carousel was Sharon Langley, who at the time was 11 months old. Later, the carousel was moved to the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and Langley visited and rode on it. In 2020, she also published a children's book called A Ride to Remember, A Civil Rights Story.
So the update here is that this carousel is currently undergoing a major conservation and restoration effort that is planned to be completed by 2025. So this spring, the carousel and its horses were all disassembled, and they were sent to Carousels and Carvings in Marion, Ohio, which specializes in restoring carousels. Now, I remember at some point in the past reading listener mail from someone whose job was restoring carousels. I could not find that old message to see if that was the place where this person worked as well. It is one of the only places that does this kind of carousel restoration in North America, though.
That would be exciting. Maybe we could get an insider update. moving on, in October of 2016, we did an episode about an unsolved murder in which a woman's remains were found in a tree in Hagley Wood in Worcestershire, England. That also ran as a Saturday classic in October of 2022. This spring, BBC Sounds released an 8-part podcast on this still unsolved case. That's called The Body in the Tree. And as we mentioned in that episode, the remains that were recovered from the tree later disappeared. And this spring, officials also put out a call for museums whose collections include human remains to see whether they have these missing remains.
Also, a new book has just come out related to this case. It is The Hagley Wood Murder, Nazi Spies, and Witchcraft in Wartime Britain by M.J. Trow. I have not read it, but it does not appear, at least as of this moment, that this publicity has led to new developments in the case. Maybe they will eventually.
Then more unearthed appearances. In 2015, we did an episode on the Gnome Serum Run, which was also a Saturday classic in January of 2022. Balto was one of the many sled dogs who were part of this life-saving mission and ultimately became the most famous. In April, research published in the journal Science compared Balto's DNA to that of more than 650 other dogs. Balto's DNA was collected from his preserved remains, which are on display at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History.
The team was examining Balto's DNA to explore his ancestry and to see how his genes compared to dogs living today. Among other things, they concluded that Balto and other working sled dogs of his era were more genetically diverse than working dogs are today.
We have a couple of updates about the Benin Bronzes. That is a broad term encompassing cultural objects and works of art that British forces looted during a punitive expedition in 1897. We covered that expedition and its aftermath in January of 2022, and we have talked about the bronzes on Unearthed in episodes both before and after that one.
Research published in PLOS ONE in April looked at where the metal used to create some of these pieces may have come from. Geochemical analysis identified one source as brass mined in Germany. This was likely introduced to West Africa as brass rings that were known as manillas, which were used as a currency during the transatlantic slave trade. There had already been some speculation that brass manillas had later been melted down and used to make these objects, but a definite ID wasn't really possible until researchers actually compared some of the Benin bronzes to manillas that had been recovered from shipwrecks.
One of the things that we talked about in that 2022 episode was the question of who exactly these objects should be returned to. The Kingdom of Benin still exists, but not in the same social and political way that it did in 1897. Britain took control of what's now the nation of Nigeria during the scramble for Africa, in which multiple European nations essentially divided the continent of Africa among themselves without any regard to the continent's existing tribes, kingdoms, nations, and other entities. So Nigeria, as it exists today, includes territory that had belonged to numerous other kingdoms, including the Kingdom of Benin. So, should the looted objects be returned to Nigeria, to the Kingdom of Benin, to the Oba of Benin, since most of the items were looted from the Oba's palace? There's also a planned museum intended to house these objects, but it is not built yet.
So, most of the returned Benin bronzes that we have talked about on the show so far have gone to Nigeria, and then some of them have been passed from Nigerian authorities to the Kingdom of Benin. But in March, outgoing Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari announced that these objects would go to Oba Oware II, who would be responsible for housing them in the Oba's palace or any other location that he and the federal government of Nigeria considered to be secure. This decision, while it was announced in March, became more widely known outside of Nigeria a little bit later in the spring.
Reactions to this have been mixed, especially outside of Nigeria. Some legal experts have said that it will make repatriations easier since the former president's announcement resolved those questions around who the objects should be returned to. Others have expressed concerns about giving one person, essentially considered by outsiders to be a private citizen at this point, total control over these objects. Some institutions that had already returned objects have issued statements saying that their return was unconditional, so it really doesn't change anything for them. But that hasn't been the case for some organizations that were in the process of returning these items. For example, in May, the University of Cambridge postponed its return of more than 100 objects after learning of that announcement.
In May, Philip Iannacco, director of the planned Edo Museum of West African Art in Nigeria, pointed out that it has taken more than a century for governments and museum officials to really start talking about returning the items that were looted from the Kingdom of Benin. But then in a lot of cases, those same people are basically criticizing Nigeria for not just instantaneously resolving complicated issues about the bronzes and how they should be handled.
We took our time, but you should hurry up. In our year end unearthed in 2021, we talked about a collection of objects that had been returned to Ethiopia. And we mentioned that Ethiopian officials were also calling for the repatriation of the body of Prince Alemayehu, son of Emperor Tewodros II. British forces took the prince and his mother to England after defeating his father's forces in 1868. The prince's mother died before reaching Britain, and after the prince died at the age of 18, Queen Victoria arranged for his body to be buried at Windsor Castle.
So there have been calls for his body to be returned to Ethiopia for a long time. And in May, officials at Buckingham Palace announced that they would not be returning the prince's body. According to a press release, quote, "It is very unlikely that it would be possible to exhume the remains without disturbing the resting place of a substantial number of others in the vicinity." Obviously, that was not a satisfactory response to the people who have been calling for this for so long.
In 2018, we did an entire Unearthed episode on Francisco Franco and the Spanish Civil War. That episode came out in the midst of ongoing debates about exhuming his remains and moving them to somewhere outside the monument then known as the Valley of the Fallen. That exhumation and reburial did ultimately happen in 2019. The monument is now known as the Valley of Cuelgamuros.
So as we discussed in that earlier episode, after this monument was constructed, the bodies of more than 30,000 people who had been killed during the Spanish Civil War were exhumed and reburied in the surrounding forest. And a lot of this happened without the knowledge or permission of the families, and in a way that really didn't clearly document where anyone had been buried after their bodies were moved. When we released that earlier episode, legal efforts for people to have their family members' remains returned to them had been going on for years. The first of these exhumations is finally underway, with exhumation of 128 victims beginning in June. This is a process where they have to, like, not only exhume people, but also like identify the remains so that they can figure out whose families they can be returned to.
And lastly, in the ongoing process of renaming U.S. military bases that had been named for Confederate leaders, Fort Polk in Louisiana was renamed Fort Johnson after New York National Guard Sergeant Henry Johnson. We talked about Johnson and the Harlem Hellfighters, which was the unit he was part of in World War I, in November of 2015. That ran as a Saturday Classic in June of 2020.
We'll talk about some food and drink after a quick sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Say goodbye to complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping, and say hello to an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Every business faces challenges, but shipping shouldn't be one of them. So keep things simple with clear, upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges for Saturday deliveries, residential deliveries, or fuel. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there, helping you counter the rising costs of doing business with a budget-friendly alternative. And keep things reliable with on-time ground shipping, ensuring your shipments get to where they need to go while maintaining your hard-earned reputation. USPS Ground Advantage is your ticket to easy, cost-effective, and dependable shipping. It's the complete delivery service your business needs to rise above the competition. There's never been a better time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable. Next, we have a whole lot of finds that are related to food and drink. First, reports came out in April about an Etruscan tomb that was unearthed in the ancient city of Volci in central Italy. This is a rock-cut tomb in the Casale dell'Osteria necropolis, and it dates back to about the 6th century BCE. What makes it really unique is that it contains a brazier with coals and meat skewers from the last meal for the deceased that was part of the funerary rites.
Next, researchers in southern Africa may have found the oldest evidence of humans eating snails. These are not little snails like you might think of with something like escargot today, but large land snails that could contain at least a couple of pounds of meat apiece. This is thanks to shell fragments in a rock shelter known as Border Cave. And those fragments date back to between 70,000 and 170,000 years ago. The shells had been heated by fire, possibly in the process of cooking the snails. While it's also possible that the shells could have been dropped in a fire by accident or burned for some other reason, there was also evidence of other items that were more conclusively food in the same area.
There was also some evidence of edible plants in the same rock shelter. It might have been a place that people prepared food and ate it together. If this is really evidence of cooking snails, that pushes back the earliest known snail consumption by a lot. Previously, humans were known to have started eating snails about 49,000 years ago in Africa, 36,000 years ago in Europe. Again, this was somewhere between 70 and 170,000 years ago for this find.
This is also similar to other finds that we've talked about in recent installments of Unearthed, discoveries that people may have been eating meat from small animals at a time when it was believed for a long while that most meat came from hunting very large animals like mammoths.
Yeah, there's been kind of a sense that it wouldn't be worth it in terms of the energy expenditure to hunt or trap or whatever a smaller animal and prepare it versus like a big mammoth that you could live off of with a lot of people for several days.
I feel like snails may be easy to hunt.
One would think. Next, archaeologists working in the ruins of Pompeii have found a fresco containing what looks like a picture of a pizza. One thing that's unusual about this fresco is that there's something as part of it that looks kind of like a pineapple, but pineapple was not introduced to Europe until almost 1,500 years after the destruction of Pompeii.
A lot of the news coverage around this made it sound like the idea of pizza in Pompeii was surprising. But we did an episode on the history of pizza way back in 2016, in which we talked about the very, very long history of topped flatbreads, stretching back long before the destruction of Pompeii. We even mentioned there being evidence of pizza in Pompeii in that episode. And it's definitely true that one thing widely associated with pizza today did not exist in Pompeii at that point, and that is tomatoes, which we have talked about on the show recently, and those were not introduced to Europe for centuries after this. Also, although there were various cheeses in Pompeii, the pizza-like food that's shown in this fresco, alas, is not covered with it.
No, that old episode on pizza does still exist in the archive. We're not running it as a Saturday classic because of all of our live shows that have come out as episodes, that one was a little fiddly, particularly fiddly in terms of quality. Like, it always sounds different when we're in a live environment, but that one in particular had some challenges. So it's there if folks want it, but we're not going to send it to everybody. In other Pompeii news, archaeologists working at the Temple of Isis have found the remains of dozens of birds, which they believe were eaten, possibly for ceremonial reasons. According to archaeologist Chiara Corbino, there had been renovations to the temple after an earthquake, and those renovations caused the temple to be slightly smaller. So priests may have conducted kind of a ritual in which they ate and also left food as an offering to Isis, kind of as an apology for the reduction in the size of the temple. The team found evidence of at least 8 charred chickens, as well as a goose and a turtle dove, and there was also some meat from a pig and some clams.
Okay, this next food might strike people as a little gross, so fair warning here. I guess you could jump ahead 30 seconds. It's not too bad. According to researchers from the University of Michigan, early human foragers may have used digesta as a food source. So in this context, digesta is the partially broken down vegetable matter found in the digestive tracts of various large herbivores. So that would include things like bison.
So the team looked at the nutrient contents of bison digesta, and researcher Raven Garvey concluded that with digesta as part of the mix, a 1,000-pound bison could sustain 25 adults for 3 days without having to supplement their carbohydrates and things by other means. So this could have been a really critical food source where the available plant matter wasn't readily digestible to humans or during times of food scarcity.
Garvey also noted that this could raise questions about gender roles in hunter-gatherer societies. There's a widespread assumption that men hunted and women gathered, but if people were getting a lot of their carbohydrates from digesta rather than from gathered plants, then that whole women were gatherers thing doesn't hold up as well.
Also, as a note, there's a ton of research that calls the idea that men were hunters and women were gatherers into question. This includes a paper that was published in PLOS ONE in June titled "The Myth of Man the Hunter, Women's Contribution to the Hunt Across Ethnographic Contexts." This paper got a lot of news coverage, and a lot of the reporting made it sound as though the idea that women may have hunted was like a brand new discovery. It really wasn't, though. This research actually involved going back through decades of already existing ethnographic studies, finding that almost 80% of them included women as hunters, like evidence of that in the study. So in a lot of ways, this paper was more about re-examining existing research and interpreting it without starting from the assumption that the men were the ones doing the hunting. There have also been, there have been a number of other papers in recent decades that have talked about women hunting, or everyone doing all of the jobs, because that was the only way that these societies could function, not that there being this like clear binary gender role.
Next, archaeologists working in the ancient city of Metsamor, Armenia, have been excavating a large 3,000-year-old structure on columns that collapsed during a fire. What they originally believed to be ash has turned out to be a thick layer of wheat flour, suggesting that more than 3 tons of flour had been stored in this building. So it seems like this may have been a huge bakery. But there's also evidence of ritual uses for flour in the region, so a little bit more study is definitely needed here.
Next, archaeologists in China's Henan province have found 2,000-year-old rice dumplings wrapped in plant leaves in the tombs of what were likely members of the nobility during the Warring States period. These dumplings are a traditional part of the Dragon Boat Festival, and these are believed to be the oldest ones ever unearthed in China.
Moving on to the potable part of edibles and potables, excavations at the 2nd century villa of the Quintili near Rome have uncovered evidence of a lavish winery. This find was something of an accident. The team was actually looking for one of the starting points for the chariot racing track at the villa's arena. We should take a moment here to remind people that villa was not a country house out in a vineyard, like you may be imagining. While it was surrounded by orchards and vineyards and farmland, this was more like a miniature city.
Yeah, I think the word villa has come to, to mean a number of different contradictory things.
Yes.
It turned out that this winery was a later addition that had been built over part of the arena. It has areas for treading on grapes and the remains of mechanical presses that would also have been used to make wine. There are at least 3 wine fountains, as well as 2 fountains that would have dispensed water. This winery also had its own dining rooms, and all of it was lavishly decorated with a lot of marble and intricate tile work.
I bet it was amazing.
It sounds great to me. I'd spend an afternoon there having tastings and stuff.
Next, research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in April has examined DNA from wine grapes grown in the Negev Highlands in what's now Israel. They analyzed grape pips from 3 different sites. One of the pips dates back to the 8th century and seems to be from a white grape and maybe the earliest example of that type of grape found so far. Researchers believe this grape may have been used to make a sweet wine known as Gaza wine, which is mentioned in historical records, but we don't really know if there's a modern equivalent.
We're not sure exactly what it might have tasted like. Other pips analyzed in this study are extremely similar to grapes that are still grown today, including the Siriki variety used to make a red wine in Greece and Lebanon, and a white grape that still grows in central Israel.
Moving on from wine to beer, according to a paper published in the journal FEMS Yeast Research in April, researchers in Germany may have pinpointed the origins of lager. That's the court brewery of Maximilian the Great, Elector of Bavaria, in Munich in 1602. Although ale brewing has been around for millennia, lager is fermented differently and requires a different type of yeast. Saccharomyces pastorianus, which is a hybrid of two other yeast species.
So for a long time, the general idea has been that Saccharomyces pastorianus came about when wild yeasts contaminated the yeast that was typically used for making ale. But these researchers had a different hypothesis, and that's that people were using a cold-tolerant strain of Saccharomyces eubianus to brew a sort of proto-lager, and that that was the yeast that became contaminated.
The source of the contamination may have been a wheat brewery. At this point, Bavaria had a brewing ordinance known as the Reinheitsgebot, which mandated that beer could only contain water, barley, and hops. But wheat beers were being made in neighboring Bohemia and imported into Bavaria. This wheat beer was really popular, particularly in the regions closest to Bohemia, which meant that Bavaria was losing out on potential revenue as people drank imported beer. So one baron was given a special permission to brew wheat beers near the Bohemian border to try to cut down on those imports. When Maximilian came to power, he took over those wheat breweries and started making wheat beer, possibly setting the stage for Saccharomyces pastorianus yeast to develop in his own breweries.
Yeah, he was brewing more stuff with more types of yeast in the same place, as I understand it. And as our last beer find, researchers have found yeast and grain in the canvases of seven Danish paintings dating back to the first half of the 19th century. That's a period known as the Danish Golden Age. In particular, they all date to between 1826 and 1833, and they were all painted by one of two artists, Christopher Wilhelm Eckersberg and Christian Kubke. Both of these were working at the Royal Danish Academy of Fine Arts in Copenhagen. So beer was expensive. Most likely what they were doing was spreading a mixture that was made with the spent mash that's used in the brewing process over their canvases to, like, make a smoother layer to paint on.
And with that in mind, let's take a quick break before we get to what I know is many people's favorite part of Unearthed.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season two of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season two of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable. Now we're going to focus on some nautical discoveries and shipwrecks for a bit. So first, a couple of years ago, some teenagers found what they thought was just a log at the bottom of Lake Waccamaw in North Carolina. It turned out to be a canoe, about 28 feet long and estimated to be 1,000 years old. This April, the teens who found it, archaeologists and members of the Waccamaw Suwan tribe and others in the community all helped raise this canoe up from the lake bed.
This was something of a two-step process. One of the boys' families had reached out to the North Carolina Office of State Archaeology back in 2021 when the canoe was first found, and at first, it had been moved closer to the family's pier. Now, it has been taken to the Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Laboratory in Greenville, North Carolina, for conservation and study.
The next few shipwrecks we're going to talk about were all pretty tragic, based on what we know of them. First, a team in Lake Michigan has found two of three vessels that all sank in a storm on November 18th, 1914. The steamship C.F. Curtis was towing two schooner barges, the Selden E. Marvin and the Annie M. Peterson. Those two schooner barges were carrying lumber. Altogether, there were 28 people aboard these three vessels, and all of them were killed.
The Curtis was found in 2021, and the Marvin was found last year, but the finds were announced in April of this year after all of the details were confirmed. The wrecks are both a bit farther away from shore than people generally thought they would be based on where they were believed to have sunk. There's also damage to the stern of the Curtis and the bow of the Marvin, so it is possible that the two collided at some point before they sunk or while they were sinking.
Further study is planned for these wrecks, including dives to the site, with the hope of both finding the Annie M. Peterson and doing additional research on the vessels that they've already found and the items that are still on board them.
Researchers have found the wreckage of the Montevideo Maru off the coast of Luzon in the Philippines. The Montevideo Maru was a Japanese merchant ship, and it sunk after being struck by a torpedo from an American submarine on July 1, 1942. But the crew aboard the submarine did not know that the Montevideo Maru was carrying Allied prisoners of war, most of them Australians who had been captured by the Japanese. Family members had been calling for Australian authorities to search for the wreck for more than a decade.
There are people from other countries as well, but the sinking of the Montevideo Maru has been described as Australia's biggest maritime disaster. And this effort to find the wreckage was a collaborative effort involving Australian authorities and companies that specialize in surveying and underwater archaeology. Now that the wreckage has been located, it's essentially a gravesite, so the plan is for it to be left undisturbed.
Researchers in Australia have also found the wreckage of the MV Blythe Star. This ship started taking on water off the coast of Tasmania in October of 1973, and its 10 crew members abandoned ship. But rescuers weren't able to find their raft at sea and ultimately called off the search. One of the crew died before the raft reached land, and two more died shortly after. After getting to shore, three went for help while the rest waited on the beach. The seven surviving crew members were found 12 days after the ship sank. And this prompted some changes to Australian maritime law, including requiring vessels to report their routes and for life rafts to be equipped with beacons.
The wreckage of the Blythe Star was found during a research voyage to study an underwater landslide off the coast of Tasmania and to map what was at that time an unidentified shipwreck known to be in the area. This process included sonar mapping and underwater photography, and it did confirm that the wreck was the Blythe Star. Part of the ship's name is actually still visible on its bow.
A team of divers has found the location of the HMS Triumph in the Aegean Sea. The Triumph was a British submarine that disappeared during World War II during a secret mission to rescue British escapees from an island in Greece. But the Triumph never arrived, and the Royal Navy declared it missing on January 23, 1942.
So now that it's been found, it's not clear exactly what happened, but the submarine's hatches were closed and the periscope was retracted. So that suggests that it was diving at the time that it sank. The hull was also seriously damaged, but it's not clear what caused the damage. Possibilities include the submarine hitting a mine or being struck by a torpedo or even being damaged by some kind of explosion from within the ship. It's possible that some further study will help answer that question.
Next, two shipwrecks discovered off the coast of Hainan Island in southern China date back to the Ming Dynasty, making them both roughly 500 years old. One of the ships was carrying an immense amount of porcelain, so many pieces that the remains of the ship itself are almost totally buried under both vessels and sand. It's estimated that the ship was carrying as many as 100,000 porcelain vessels intended as exports. The other wreck was carrying timbers, probably being imported into China for use in shipbuilding. This is being described as an important find in understanding the maritime Silk Road, because it's the first time that a ship carrying imports and one carrying exports have been found in the same area.
Further study of this area is planned, but it's also challenging due to how deep these wrecks are. They are down more than 1,500 meters.
In our last shipwreck, a plan to raise a 39-foot-long, 3,000-year-old, hand-sewn boat from the seafloor was announced in June. The vessel was found in the Bay of Zambratia in Croatia, and it dates back to between the 12th and 10th centuries BCE. This may be the oldest surviving hand-sewn boat in the Mediterranean, and it's being raised so it can be studied further.
So this process was scheduled to start on July 2nd, with the pieces being desalinated in Croatia and then sent to France for restoration probably sometime in 2024. The long-term hope is that after some restoration and study, this hand-sewn vessel can become part of the collection at a maritime history museum.
And now we've got a couple of discoveries related to the Viking-era Norse. First, research published in April suggests that the Norse may have abandoned settlements in southwest Greenland due to sea level rise. The Norse occupied Greenland from about 985 to 1450, and there have been various theories about why that settlement ended. But it happened after the start of a period of global cooling known as the Little Ice Age. This seems a little bit counterintuitive because you might imagine that if the planet was cooler, more of the water would be frozen as ice and sea levels would be lower. But the weight of all the ice also pressed down on the land masses underneath it. And according to researchers, the increased mass of the ice also led to a greater gravitational effect on the water.
So this research suggests a variety of effects from this sea level rise, including periods of flooding and a change in the foods that were available for people to eat, and that might have been one of the reasons that the Norse left Greenland.
Another study has looked at where the Norse were getting their lumber during this period. Various Norse sagas describe wood being brought from Vinland. That's northeastern North America, centered on what's now Newfoundland. Wood was also brought from Europe, either transported as timber or as wooden items, or repurposed from things like ships' hulls. And driftwood was an important source of lumber in Greenland, possibly making up more than half of the wood that was used in the structures that were part of this study.
These researchers looked at a collection of sites that included four farms and an episcopal manor, using radiocarbon dating to confirm the ages of the wood, and microscopic analysis to define which types of trees the wood came from. Only a very, very tiny percentage was conclusively determined to have been imported lumber, just about 0.25%. But about 25% of the wood could have been intentionally imported or could have been gathered as driftwood, and some of that wood came from hemlocks and jack pines, which are trees that grew in North America and not Europe, meaning that's where they have to have come from.
And closing out part one of Unearthed, we have a few surprises, starting with objects that turned out to be way more notable and valuable than people expected when they bought them. First, in 2017, a woman bought 4 ceramic plates at a Salvation Army for $8. It turns out those plates were made by Pablo Picasso, and she sold 3 of them for more than $40,000. The 4th plate is signed by Picasso, and it is currently in a safe deposit box. While all of this happened in 2017 and 2018, it made headlines this year after the buyer told her story on TikTok.
Next, last year, an antiquities collector heard that the former St. Paul's Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia was going through a conversion after being sold, and that collector offered to buy the church's stained glass windows. Settled on a price of $6,000. But then when the buyer had the windows appraised, turned out they had been made by Tiffany Studios and they were worth as much as $25,000. They wound up selling at auction for $100,000 each.
And an old metal cylinder sold at a flea market in Hertfordshire for £20, it's about $25, turned out to be a late medieval hand cannon made of bronze. It was sold at auction in June for £1,000.
And lastly, these are not things that people sold, but we have 2 art surprises. First, an X-ray fluorescent scan has revealed that Pablo Picasso's 1900 painting, Le Moulin de la Galette, used to have a dog in the foreground, a little brown spaniel dog wearing a red bow. It's very cute. Picasso, though, ultimately painted over the dog with kind of a sort of lumpy, drapey thing. It looks a little bit like a black coat draped over a chair. It's kind of, it's not very shaped very definitively. In the other, chef and visual artist Ernst de Witte realized that Vincent van Gogh's 1887 painting that was formerly known as Red Cabbages and Onions is not of red cabbages and onions. Those onions were actually bulbs of garlic. Which, when you look at it with that knowledge, you're like, yes, that's garlic.
That is a fun place to wrap up part one of Unearthed. There is more coming next time.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, do you have listener mail?
I do. I have listener mail from Rebecca, who wrote, "Hi, Holly and Tracy. Thanks so much for your recent episodes on the Dictionary Wars. I'm from West Hartford, Connecticut, so I grew up hearing a lot about Noah Webster. His house was a frequent destination for school field trips, and the main branch of the public library is named after him. Obviously, they left out a lot of the story for the elementary school version of his life on those tours of his house. The biggest Webster-centric event in West Hartford was the annual Noah Webster birthday party in the fall, which included a spelling bee for kids. Fortunately, we did not have to spell according to Webster's particular rules, but I can't help thinking he would have sympathized with me the year I got eliminated for misspelling morgue." If you're like, what did Tracy just say? That's the word M-O-R-G-U-E. "I'm sure he would not have approved of those extra letters. In my defense, I didn't recognize the word from its pronunciation because I had only ever read it and had never heard it out loud before. You know how it is. Another year, though, I won the spelling bee in my AIDS division, and the prize was, of course, a Merriam-Webster dictionary. Finally, a cute animal picture. I don't have any pets, alas, but there has been a bumper crop of baby bunnies in my neighborhood this year. I hope this picture conveys just how teeny this little bunny is in comparison to the grass and leaves around it. Thank you for all of your great podcasts, fun behind-the-scenes commentary, and excellent research. I look forward to stuff you miss in history class every week, and I can't wait to see what you'll be working on next. Take care, Rebecca." This is a very cute little bunny. We have lots of bunnies in our yard, which I just let them do what they're doing because we have not tried to grow any kind of foods that the bunnies might decide are delicious. Even when I had a pretty nice little herb garden growing on our deck, the rabbits didn't really mess with it. So yeah, very cute bunny. I love this story on Noah Webster's birthday party. If you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com, and we're all over social media at Missing History. That's where you'll find our Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. And you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ+ bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.